The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they're lazy, but because they are hard.
Three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we're very fortunate to have a terrific guest with us today, Dr. Scott Pace. But first, just a couple of quick announcements. We're focusing on 60 minutes, but we will extend based on your participation, phone calls, emails, and whatever it is we're talking about. But do keep in mind that it's primarily on the 60-minute track. Our telephone number is 1-866-687-7223. You can email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Our website newsletter and upcoming show menu on the far right of our homepage are already up and running for the coming week. And one thing to note, there will be no show a week from today on July 4th. That's a holiday. We're not going to do a program that day, and I hope everyone has a great holiday and understands the importance of what this holiday is all about. Our newsletter will go out tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. California time. If you want to be added to it, make sure I have your email address. Remember, everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website or easily download a program or on most any podcast server that you're using. We have a store if you're interested in logo wear, and you get there by clicking on Pepper Listening to the Space Show. And in the upper left Listen Live menu, this tells you how to listen to live broadcasts like we're doing now, archives off of our website, and podcast. And if you have questions or comments or need some troubleshooting help, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do remember that the Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit. We're supported in our activities by listeners just like you, and we appreciate your contributions. They do keep the program going. As a nonprofit, you're entitled to a tax deduction if you're paying federal U.S. taxes, and the same is true if you're a California taxpayer. If you have any questions, visit oneonegiantleapfoundation.org. That's our parent. Or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. One more little note, that the Space Show is a trademark name, in case any of you wonder or have a question about that, and it's been trademarked for about 18 years now. If you have any questions about our trademark, I'm happy to share the information with you. Just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. The best way to support the Space Show is through PayPal. There's a big PayPal button at the top of our homepage. Checks are always welcome at One Giant Leap Foundation. They mail to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And we also have sponsors, and they get that banner ad going across our homepage. And as today is the 60-minute format, I shout out to our great sponsors. We wouldn't be doing the program without their help: Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society, which just completed another very successful ISDC. Still all virtual. Hopefully that will change next year and we can get back to going to ISDC in person. It's a great event virtually, but a better event, in my opinion, if we get to go there in person. So as I said at the start, our guest today is Dr. Scott Pace. We're happy to have him back with us. He is the former executive secretary of the National Space Council. He is the director of the Space Policy Institute at the Elliott School of International Affairs at GWU. His full bio is on our Space Show website. I urge you to read it. And if you're not familiar with Dr. Pace, you can become familiar. And we're, as I said, very, very happy to have Scott back on the program. Welcome back to the Space Show, Scott. It's very good to talk to you again.
Hey, David. Glad to be here.
So I want to start out because on June 18th, you did an op-ed on Space News about there's a stall in space traffic management due to NOAA, and space traffic management seems to be one of those givens, you know, so it's hard to understand why there would be a stall in wanting to implement SPD-3, which laid the groundwork for it, Space Policy Directive 3 from the National Space Council. So tell us what's going on with traffic management.
Well, by way of background, SPD-3 on space traffic management was one of the third directives that the Space Council did. It was not something that we were planning on doing early on, but as we saw the rate of launch of large constellations, you know, like Starlink going on, it became really clear that we needed to kind of accelerate that things were developing pretty rapidly. So we had a large interagency process, including Commerce and Transportation and Defense and State and all the members of the Space Council to kind of really work through at a pretty detailed level. And one of the things that was very clear is that while DOD has been providing data for a long time, they didn't want to continue that role. They had other things they wanted to focus on for national security purposes. They had no desire to be a traffic cop or a kind of a public service function like that for civilian and commercial activities. They really had enough military things to do. And the other thing that was clear was that even the data they were providing really wasn't as timely or as high resolution enough to meet what was coming. It's maybe okay for geosynchronous satellites or occasional things, but if we're talking large numbers, hundreds if not thousands of satellites, the data needed to be a lot more timely than they were providing. So out of that came the idea of an open architecture data repository. That is a kind of an open environment, say a cloud service, in which, yes, the DoD data would come in. We'd combine it with data from other sources, commercial sources. There are companies like Leo Labs or Exo Analytics that are already taking data that's very precise and very timely, and put that into a kind of repository. It's kind of like a zeroth order reference source. People would still maybe do more high-resolution activities for their own purposes, but as a basic public service activity, because we don't want things crashing into each other, there would be this public access repository. And we would limit the amount of accuracy and the amount of timeliness because we wanted to still preserve the option for commercial companies to, of course, make their own businesses and their own specialized services. So that's the basic idea. The FAA and the Department of Transportation had for many years raised the issue of space traffic management. They have to deal with this when doing launches. They want to make sure you don't hit anything on the way up or anything coming on the way down. But it was also very clear that the FAA already had a lot on its plate that it had to deal with, that it didn't have, it had the interest, but didn't really have all the capabilities that you would need for doing space traffic management. And so this had gone back and forth for some time. It was also clear that Transportation Department at the time didn't really want to take this job on itself. Again, it had other higher priority issues with air traffic. So after everything sorted itself out, we came down to assigning this to the Commerce Department. There was a way forward. As of last year, there had been Industry Day where there were about 250 people showed up, various companies, kind of products they could do. And essentially, it was on a process to stand up a kind of a 1.0 version of this open architecture repository. And unfortunately, combination of things, NOAA didn't request the full amount of money through the president's budget that it needed for the office. It started re-looking at, maybe to use maybe a more provocative term, relitigate some of the choices. It wasn't clear that they wanted to do this job. So they began funding some of our federally funded research and development centers, all wonderful people who do great things. But again, it was re-looking at a very, traditional style of doing a government procurement, if you will, a kind of a program of record. And that's kind of where we are today. That is, we've got a policy that people seem happy with. We have a need that's increasingly clear. We have a technical way forward that industry, I think, all recognizes. But we have a bureaucracy that really hasn't caught up. And I have to say, this is not something that seems to be a policy change. There doesn't seem to be an opposition at either the White House or at the Secretary of Commerce level. This really has to do more with a somewhat of a traditional agency doing traditional things, but at a speed which is not commensurate with the need. Oh, let me pause there.
So what's the way around this? How do you get an agency to do things at a faster speed, or can you move an agency?
Well, I mean, the first thing is attention, and the front office, that is Secretary of Commerce's office, is paying more attention to this. Congress is certainly engaged. Again, there were different views, particularly in the Senate side, about, hey, should FAA do this or should Commerce do this? They actually mandated a study by the National Academy of Public Administration that took about 6 months to go back and do a separate objective look in detail as to whether or not we made the right choice. I was gratified that they came back with, yes, we did make the right choice in terms of assigning roles and responsibilities. So it's the usual tools. We have leadership in the Commerce Department that presses on it. We have congressional interest that presses on it. And as typical with these things, they either start going in the right direction or Congress starts becoming more and more prescriptive over time. And generally, if you're in the agency, you don't really want Congress telling you what to do in great detail. You'd like to take care of it yourself, which is, I think, everybody's preference. But the Congress will become more prescriptive because this is really important to the country. If we have, you know, another major accident or a problem, then people are going to be asking, well, you know, who knew what and when did they know it and how come more progress wasn't made? I'm hoping that after a certain amount of light is shown on this topic, hence my op-ed piece, that people will eventually decide to do the right thing.
So your op-ed piece talks about NOAA implementing additional, I think you said, three studies. So
I have a couple of studies going with different FFRDCs.
Are they needed?
Is the question, are they needed?
Are those studies needed or superfluous?
Well, to be truthful, I'd have to look specifically at the terms of reference and what they were doing. So, I can't, as a former analyst, I can't really rule out, or now as a current analyst, I guess, I can't rule out there isn't some value added for these studies. And again, I have smart people working on them. I think where I would come down is I probably would not have done those studies because I would have thought that there was adequate information already available as of last year as to what we needed to do going forward. And the results of the request for information, the industry days, the level of technical readiness that I think could already see in the company, I think would have been sufficient. And again, we had gone through a very in-depth process, both with the NAPA study that Congress mandated as well as the interagency process, that there's not a lot to do, unless there's some question that I'm completely unaware of, which is possible. So I can't rule out that there may be some utility in the studies, but from where we stood at the end of 2020, I wouldn't have seen them as necessary.
You have an email question already from our listener, Todd, is in San Diego, and he said, is space traffic management today complicated strictly because of the number of Starlink satellites being launched into LEO? Is that the main driver for the problem?
Oh, no. And, in fact, given how well characterized the satellites are, and we know where they are, and they're cooperative and so forth, you know, I wouldn't say so. It certainly makes it more dramatic and visible when you start talking about the numbers of those kinds of satellites. But the, one of the primary threats really is the things you really can't see, or timeliness of data. For example, the Chinese ASAT test done back in 2007, there's still thousands of pieces of debris that are still working their way down from that. The Iridium-Cosmos collision created lots of debris. There's things up there that are smaller than about 10 centimeters that certainly can be hazardous, but again, it's hard to see. So if you know exactly where something is, you can kind of work with that. It's the things you can't see which are the problem, and it's also how timely the data is, that the last time you took an observation was, you know, a few weeks ago, then the predicted orbit can be quite off. You want to have data that is repeated, more temporal resolution, if you will. So there are certain regions that are more congested than others. Low Earth orbit, you know, several hundreds of kilometers up, up to, say, space station altitudes. That's a concern. But having lots and lots of satellites by itself is not a problem. It's how good is your situational awareness. And that's an area where we need some of these new commercial services to kind of keep up with the numbers of satellites that are up there and to deal with the problem of debris.
Is the U.S. the only country pursuing situational awareness? Do we have duplication of efforts by other space countries? What's the status of that internationally?
Oh, I wouldn't say there's duplication. There's certainly other people who are involved. You know, the Europeans, the French in particular, have a radar observation program. The Russians have a quite extensive optical network looking for things. So optical and radar are the two primary techniques that are used. I would say probably the U.S. is probably the most capable and the most widespread, but the Chinese, the Russians, the Europeans all have capabilities. And we have actually agreements with a number of countries for exchange of space situational awareness data. Now, the exchange tends to be more one way, that we're providing more than we're getting, but every little bit helps. And so we will get in cooperative programs to data share. You know, countries will contribute observations that they're making, again, either radar or optical around the world. So I would say that we're the leader, but Europe, Russia, and China are both big players, and we're trying to stay ahead, I hope, by relying on commercial innovation.
You already have a phone call from a listener, and hello, listener, who are you and where are you? And we appreciate your call.
Good afternoon, David. It's Michael Listener here from New Hampshire.
Hi, Michael. Good to hear from you again.
Likewise. Not so much a question as, you know, I just want to take the opportunity to, you know, congratulate Dr. Pace and his team during the 4 years during the Trump administration. You all just pulled it together and really covered a lot of territory with space policy. I mean, I was absolutely giddy and really enthusiastic. And talking with friends in other countries, they were very impressed, too, with the amount of coverage that that you made during those 4 years.
Well, Michael, well, thank you. It's not often people refer to space policy and being giddy.
I think
you and I are probably among the few people who have those reactions. But yes, I was in general very happy with it, and obviously I got to give credit to my boss, who the vice president, who gave me top cover. Mm-hmm. But I also have to give credit to the interagency. I mean, I think one of the reasons I've also been happy with the transition in the Biden administration, while I have much disagreed with the Biden administration on non-space issues, on space issues, I've been very, very happy with it. And in part, I think that's because it wasn't just, you know, some bright idea me and my friends had, but we really tried to get everybody involved. We got all the stakeholders and the agencies involved so that the policy directions that we all kind of came to I think represented a very strong, you know, consensus, a nonpartisan consensus that people were comfortable with. So that's, I'm hoping for more stability, sustainability as we go forward.
Well, that's encouraging. So, like I said, you all covered a lot of territory and just made some really really significant gains. And, being in this field and writing about this field and talking about the field, it's encouraging from this perspective.
No, thank you. Very kind of you.
And that's about it, David. Oh, Dr. Pace, if you do me a favor and just give my regards to Dr. Johnson, I appreciate it.
I will. She's still teaching this week at Georgetown, wrapping up for the summer. But I will give her your regards.
Thank you. I haven't talked to her in quite a while.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, bye, there.
Okay, thank you, Scott. There were, I believe, 7 space policy directives. Are they still all in play? Do they have the force of law, or more? Is it more like an executive order?
They're more like executive orders. They're basically space policy directives, presidential memorandum, executive orders. All basically are created by a president and can only be undone by a president. So some policies, of course, can be undone by the next president with a stroke of the pen. But if they're not touched, then they continue. So it's policy until someone changes it. An example of things that are even more firm are things like the Space Force, which we created a policy directive on what the legislative proposal for the Space Force should look like. But, of course, creating a new armed service and amending Title 10 of the U.S. Code to create a new armed service, that required legislation. And so that was passed in the National Defense Authorization Act, and that would require an act of Congress to undo. So presidential policy is presidential policy until the president decides to change it, which is why I'm gratified with the general stability so far that the Biden administration has shown toward things like Artemis and Space Force. And space traffic management is one of the few things where I think there's been a shortfall. And again, I don't think it was a policy problem. I think it was an implementation problem, which can kill you just as well as policy can. So hence I wanted to get more attention on it.
So all 4 space policy directives are still in play?
All 7 are still in place. The executive order creating the Space Council is in place. I wouldn't be surprised if the Biden administration probably issued their own executive order, updating it. They may want to add people to the Space Council, or they may want to, maybe make some changes and how it's organized. They said they're going to keep it. But that doesn't mean they're going to keep it identically. So I would expect an executive order on the Space Council coming from this administration, which will supersede the prior ones. We had, a couple of documents that were done not by the Space Council, but by the Office of Science and Technology Policy, dealing with things like planetary protection and R&D for orbital debris mitigation. So not all space things happened in the Space Council. We coordinate everything, but there are other parts of the building that also, had space responsibilities, National Security Council, National Economic Council, OSTP, and so on. But we were the centerpiece, but that doesn't mean we had a monopoly on everything.
Do you have any information on who might be named the next executive director?
No idea. Typical Washington game, you'll hear, speculations about this person or that person. But, it's the classic Washington parlor game. It's not real until the White House announces it.
In terms of space law, commercial space still, being a big part of what's happening in the United States, do you see all of that staying fairly stable or even progressing in intensity?
Yes. Yeah, actually, and it's a good point, because 2 major areas that we did regulatory reform with was on commercial launch and commercial remote sensing. We shifted to more of a market-based approach on commercial remote sensing, where if something was already available in the market, there was kind of like no point in the U.S. trying to restrict it. So rather than drawing technically arbitrary lines, this level of resolution or this many imaging bands, we really just looked at what the market was doing. And in the case of launch, we wanted to streamline the process to handle the higher flight rates, particularly that SpaceX was pressing with. So The previous regulations didn't really deal well with reusable vehicles. They didn't deal well with high flight rates. FAA took the opportunity to go back really to bare wood and build a new set of regulations. I should do a shout out here because initially the estimation was it would take 5 years to do the update. And when we kind of made it really clear that that wasn't really an acceptable date, they actually turned around and got a draft out in a year and got a final rule published in 2 years, which is really, really impressive. Those guys worked really hard to get that updated. So those things are, you know, in regulation, and those are not things that can be easily changed. So it's not quite as bad as legislation, but I think that's certainly very stable. I think the area in regulation where we didn't make as much progress or where the progress maybe was more mixed was with the Federal Communications Commission, which, of course, plays a large role in space activities. So they have an ongoing rulemaking on orbital debris mitigation. They're dealing with the large mega constellations and where do they go and what do they do. They affect ground stations, whether you get a license to put a ground station in any particular place. They have licensing fees. FCC is one of the few entities in the world that is basically pretty much supported by user fees. So unlike other countries, they do charge you significant amounts of money, which, of course, encourages companies to go offshore, which I don't think is really great. I prefer people to come here. So we had some progress, I think, in the FCC being open to letting people experiment and try with the large constellations. We had some areas where we made less progress. One of them in particular that I disagreed with was allowing operations of a mobile broadband service in a band adjacent to GPS, which I think was technically wrong, but the commission, you know, ruled otherwise. And so now the Congress is taking that up and investors are looking at it. It's still an ongoing concern about potential interference from the GPS industry. So a bit of a more of a mixed bag with the FCC. Some things positive, some things not.
The country's pretty divided. Did you find that regarding your space work that there was a lot of division or was there a lot of unity?
I probably had the best job on the White House campus because everybody likes space. You know, I mean, you're right about the polarization. I mean, things like popular entertainment or sports, all that have fairly well politicized, and it was hard. There's divisions. No doubt about it. But in the space area, we've had a lot of very positive support, and tended to be bipartisan or nonpartisan. American people are very supportive, you know, of it. I mean, you know, everybody, of course, has their opinions and differences, and we can argue about programmatics and things like that. But I think one of the reasons we wanted to work really hard to stay nonpartisan was because it felt it was very important to have a unifying element at a time of polarization. And so finding something, I got situations, for example, celebrating like the first all-female astronaut spacewalk, and both Nancy Pelosi and Vice President Pence are tweeting about it. And, if I can get that kind of coming together, I'll take it. Jim Bridenstine was terrific. He worked really hard across the aisle, first reaching out to people who were skeptical of him, like Bill Nelson. He reached out to Nancy Pelosi, reached out to NASU, talked about the importance of the first, American woman on the moon. And so he did a lot of work also to be nonpartisan. Space and NASA in particular are way too delicate to let it get dragged into partisan fights. It just doesn't help the program any. So I think we worked really hard at trying to be nonpartisan and unifying, and for the most part it seemed to work.
I have another email, and this is from Barbara in Tucson. And she says, Dr. Pace, I'm curious where you come down on the argument about China is a national security threat. David has many national security people on the space show. Apparently, he really likes that topic. His latest has been another round of appearances by Dr. Goswami. Most of these people all talk about how serious the national security threat is, but I'm on the same email group with another very well-known person who you probably know, but I'm not going to say his name, and they're dismissing China this morning as a national security threat and pointing to articles that are reincarnating the space war, Cold War, during the Apollo era. I'm curious where you come down on China as a national security threat, especially with their space policy.
Well, I think one of the things you can say is that, you know, China's a big place, and pretty much you can see almost any aspect in it. I mean, there are parts of China that are impressive, and, you know, and seeing what they've done, you know, sort of technically and what they've done with their economy. And there are parts of China that, really are a threat and really are a problem. You look at their behavior in the South China Sea and Hong Kong and so forth, and you can't help but shake your head and go, you know, this is just not good. But not everything China does is a threat. And, you know, you can't paint, I think, with a fully broad brush. I would say that China is overall is a military and a threat and is a diplomatic threat. But on the other hand, I think there are areas where we could find to cooperate with China. You know, I'd like to see lunar sample exchanges, the exchange of biomedical data. I could imagine if we're both going to be on the South Pole of the Moon, I could imagine we need to coordinate somehow and consult with each other if we're both going to be operating in the same regime. I don't see any fundamental reason why China couldn't be part of the Artemis Accords. I don't see that they will be integral or part of, say, some of our program activities. I don't see human spaceflight cooperation with China anytime soon. But I can certainly imagine operational coordination. I can certainly imagine scientific coordination. And China building a space station or doing Mars exploration, to me, is much less threatening than some of the things they're doing in the South China Sea or some of the things that they're developing militarily to hold our space assets at risk. What China is doing, for example, in counter space anti-satellite weapons is very concerning. So it's a mix. And I think we could do some more cooperation in some areas, but I think we're right to be cautious in others. If we look how China has behaved in other shared domains, you know, whether it's cyberspace or the high seas or even Antarctica, you know, space is an area where we go, is this going to be different? It could be. I guess I hold out some hope and engagement. Our engagement with China, for example, at the UN on the Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space and discussing space resources, I think have been very constructive, and I think we're actually see eye to eye on a number of matters in space. But you also have to look at the total picture of China, which is somewhat problematic. So anyway, sorry if it's kind of a convoluted answer, but, you know, the short answer is it depends on where you're looking.
Are they actually developing a commercial industry? So I hear it's totally subsidized and not actually commercial. They're trying to get a couple of commercial companies going, or from your perspective, are they truly entering into a commercial environment?
It's the question of what's commercial in China, but again, it's a mix. There are some things which are, you know, classic state-owned enterprises where commercial is defined as whatever makes revenue, but there are other companies that, you know, pretty much walk and talk like, you know, we would think of as an entrepreneurial, you know, small startup. So there's a range of companies there in China. Are they active? Are there companies which are active in pretty much every commercial space sector you can think of? Yes, there are. From, you know, small sats to launch vehicles, communications, navigation, remote sensing. They're active across the board and increasingly so. Do they operate in a economic environment, which is very somewhat different than ours? Yes, they do. And so the question is, unlike the Soviet Union, which never was really an economic threat to the West, China's behavior in a number of areas of the economy is a problem. And I think what you're seeing is a consensus about, at the very least, trying to disentangle critical supply chains. You know, relying on China for medical supplies out of COVID is something I think people are rethinking. We look at companies like, you know, Huawei and cyber intrusions. And so disentangling 5G supply chains from China seems like a good thing. Are we going to stop trading with China? Of course not. Are we going to try to make sure we have more diversity and don't have over-reliance on China for things that are critical to our well-being, whether it's space or telecom or medicine? Yeah, we are. And that's also another area, interestingly, of consensus that's happened, I think, in the past decade or so. You know, a decade ago, you could still get debates about what the direction China is going in and how it will be evolving. Is it a threat? Is it not? You know, the Washington policy community has pretty much shifted that way. The behavior of the Central Committee and the Communist Party has been pretty bad over the last several years. And so I think perceptions of China have certainly hardened more. Do we have to go along with them? Yes. Do we think they're just like us? No.
You have another phone call already. So, hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please? Hello, caller. Are you there? Caller? Well, they're still connected because I don't have a dial tone that they've hung up. So, caller, if you'd like to call us back, please do so. And the toll-free number is 866-687-7223. What are the chances of China coming forward and wanting to participate in Artemis?
Well, I think they've expressed sort of interest. They, of course, have recognized that that the U.S. still has the Wolf Amendment, which it doesn't really bar, but it sets a high hurdle toward bilateral space cooperation. So I don't see them necessarily being in Artemis programmatically the way, say, Japan, Canada, Europe are involved. But, you know, could we imagine some sort of, you know, scientific and operational coordination? You know, sure. We have committees that deal, international committees that deal with open standards for telecom and navigation, and so common use of open standards for, say, cross support during a mission is something you certainly think about. So I would see it more of a coordinated activity rather than a direct cooperation activity. And we've always held the door open for things, like the phrase is, transparent, reciprocal, and mutually beneficial. And we can find activities that meet those criteria on a case-by-case basis. And I think we should explore them. But again, this is the reason there are these kind of strictures there is not because of China's space behavior, the anti-satellite weapons tests in 2007 notwithstanding, but because of the broader political context. I've often say that a lot of times space people don't quite understand that space doesn't exist in isolation from other aspects of a relationship. That is, if we have a really good relationship, then doing more by cooperating in space is easy. If we have a bad relationship, cooperation in space is not going to make that bad relationship better. Space tends to be a lagging indicator of the overall relationship, and political changes and trust have to kind of be built first, and then you can kind of cement them and symbolize them with space cooperation.
You have another phone call. Let's see if it's our caller from before. Good afternoon, caller. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hey, it's me. It's Steve in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
Wonderful. I wanted to echo what the previous caller said was giddy. I mean, I'll go there. I was pretty excited with what I saw over the last 3 years, especially after watching the shuttle retirement become a Toyota commercial. I kind of feel like America's kind of reawakened, and you know, people like Dr. Space here keeping that light going over these years. My question regarding all these changes, and we have like Space Force, and you'd mentioned NOAA earlier. I'm echoing what the other caller said. I like it when NASA is doing space things, and I don't know how their office works. I have sent personal letters to people and found that it's really hard to nail down exactly what office you need to send something to, whether it be a letter of congratulations to a astronaut or a question to a scientist. So it's very spread out is my point. Has there ever been, or did you experience any talk about, I know government doesn't want to get smaller, but like, is there a time when NOAA and the EPA, there's like an Office of Environmental Science in which they're focused on those sorts of things, and maybe, you know, hey NASA, we need to find the best person to do this research for us, and they're tasked to do those things instead of budgets and sort of the focus of the agency being spread out so wide. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Has there ever been consolidation talk?
Yeah. It's not so much consolidation as trying to avoid, you know, trying to avoid duplicating or doing things that other people either are already doing or could do better at. It's kind of an old example, but one thing, I did a tour in NASA in the Bush administration, Bush 43, and the Earth Science program at the time was running a lot of small application efforts. They would give out grants, and people would do fun science and come back with looking at, again, water and earth and air pollution and things like that. But it was really duplicative, or it was not really, and really wasn't any better in quality than things that the National Science Foundation was already doing, or even parts of NOAA were already doing. And so we looked at that and said, you know, NASA shouldn't be in the retail part of the business, you know, down with individual scientists. You know, we should be more at the wholesale end of things, you know, creating the data sets, creating the large systems that then go and enable these guys to go do things better. We should be creating the space data such that the agriculture department or the EPA or whatever can be more effective. We shouldn't try to duplicate what it is they're doing. And so, you know, we reoriented the Earth Science and Applications Program to a lot more at the basic science end of things and sort of try to pay more attention to how can we support other agencies doing their missions rather than trying to duplicate their missions. There's a lot of movement that goes back and forth between NASA, at least the science part of NASA, and NOAA. You'll find during their careers it's not uncommon for a NASA person to go spend a couple of years over at NOAA, or a NOAA person will rotate back into NASA, and I think that's generally good. People don't spend their entire careers just in one agency. I think that's probably good. An area where there's been recent discussion is the Biden administration wants to emphasize, you know, climate change research and, you know, what can NASA do in climate change. And there, I'm, again, back to my retail versus wholesale analogy, I'm pretty nervous or be reluctant to see NASA get into the climate change business per se, because they really don't have, you know, sort of some of the expertise they need. What they can do is they can provide the science data. There's already a very robust Earth science program within NASA. The science priorities are those come from decadal surveys for the National Academy of Sciences. You can always do more. There's always some additional mission someone wants to do. But it's already pretty good. So I would see NASA being called upon to help and support maybe climate change research. I would hate to see it be redirected to go in an area that it may not have the expertise to do. So rather than consolidation, I think it's more like defining clearly what swim lanes people ought to be in. Figure out what their lane is, do their job really well, and don't try to do someone else's job, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, unfortunately, it reminds me of, you know, I stumbled across C-SPAN once and saw Michael Crichton giving a talk about State of Fear, his book, in which he was talking about non-science people making science decisions for us, and perhaps certain studies being commissioned that were to feed a narrative, not necessarily do the science to figure out what's going on. And that's who got the money versus the person who is just trying to figure something out and without being partisan.
Let me jump on that and point out that's an example of an area where you want to keep the regulatory part separate from the science part. You know, for example, you'll have EPA doing environmental regulation. One could agree or disagree with what they're doing, the intent or whatever, but that's their job, okay, is to worry about environmental regulation. NOAA, doing weather systems, or NASA doing even more basic science work, NOAA and NASA should not do regulation. And you don't want EPA doing the science part or doing the space systems part, because that would potentially pollute or, sorry for the pun, that would potentially affect their ability to use regulation. So the people providing the data shouldn't be necessarily the ones using the data. It's kind of like a checks and balances. Kind of that
totally.
I want the science guys doing science. That's great. And I got these other people over here thinking about the regulatory application, and I don't want to cross the stream.
I'd like to point out that there have been really bad actor scientists around the world over the years. Just think back into World War II. So who watches the scientist?
Right. Yeah, and this is why peer review is important. This is why open debate is important. This is why keeping people kind of in their lanes, doing science and not trying to, mix it too. Obviously, as individual citizens, one can have one's opinions and lobby and campaign and so forth. But that's different than, anything that potentially could be wound up distorting the science or attempting to use it, for political ends.
Okay.
Thank you for answering my question.
Steve, is it cooling off in Las Vegas?
Feeling good, man.
Okay.
Just a little sweaty.
Just a little sweaty. Well, I'm going to be in touch with you soon, so I will talk to you about that off air down the road. Thank you for your call.
All right, cheers.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, everybody.
Bye-bye. Listener, the line is available and still plenty of time. If you would like to call us, it is 1-866-687-7223, and that reference to Las Vegas is I'm actually seriously thinking of moving there, so the temperature scares me, but... So just staying in California. So I don't know where I'm motivated by fear mode. Scott, did the National Space Group ever think about something for space debris mitigation?
Oh, yeah. And my colleagues over in OSTP at the end of the administration had published a R&D plan for orbital debris mitigation. And so that's a pretty, you can Google that up. It's still on the website for the Trump administration archives. And again, I think the agencies came together on that, and I think they're still want to pursue a number of those topics. In terms of companies, the thing that people ask the most about is active debris removal. I mean, just going up, getting something and bringing it back in. That obviously doesn't work for really tiny pieces of debris. Like the smaller than 10 centimeter threat that I mentioned. But it certainly works for very large, massive objects, which could become potential debris in the future. Now, unfortunately, a lot of these objects are spent Russian and Chinese upper stages that still belong to Russia and China. So we can't go up and move them without permission. There's no such thing as abandoned property. We don't have salvage law in space. And so on the one hand, we have increasing capabilities to go in and grab and remove objects. Northrop Grumman demonstrated a maneuver via mission extension vehicle where they docked with an old Intelsat satellite and basically providing it an additional 5 years of life. We have a number of commercial proposals for satellite servicing that the Japanese company called Astroscale just looked, at doing space debris cleanup, again, docking with objects and bringing them in. what we don't really have are a well-defined set of safe practices for doing these things. You know, what does it mean to do this in a safe and professional way? Asking permission. How close do you come before you need additional permission? How do you dock with an object, making sure you don't make it worse? What do you do about to safe the vehicle? Things like still has fluids in it, maybe, or still has a corroded battery or something like that. So coming up with safe procedures and best practices for rendezvous and proximity operations, this, I think, is the next big cutting-edge area. Certainly within the UN world, where we talk about guidelines for sustainable space activities, including orbital debris mitigation, I think kind of the next topic was these rendezvous and proximity and active debris removal activities. It makes people nervous because, of course, these capabilities are dual use. They can be used to harm a satellite as well as, you know, get rid of an old derelict threat. So research, active debris removal, improving space situational awareness, those are some of the major thrusts for you know, keeping the environment stable for use for decades to come.
Is the debris at a critical point yet? Is this something that needs resolutions now, and we're dragging our feet, or how do you see that?
It's not so much that, you know, we're not near, you know, people can argue about this. In my perception, it's not that we're near a Kessler syndrome tipping point, you know, right now. And we're still away from that. We could definitely increase our margin of safety a lot by removing, you know, 5 or 6 major objects each year, just at a very steady rate. There are particular regimes that are probably more dangerous and crowded than others. So we could certainly improve our margin of safety. The thing where there's a certain urgency is we have these large constellations going up, and there's billions of dollars at stake. And the financial community recognizes that they've got a risk exposure. And so it needs to have, you know, good space situational awareness data such that we have a stable investment environment. Again, it's not like we're going to go into a runaway Kessler syndrome, you know, within a few years and we don't do anything. But we are running risks by not getting these new systems up. And again, the government, the DOD, is not going to be the one that's able to do that. Their systems are older systems. They have got other military things that they need to go do. So even if we wanted to keep the DOD in its current role of providing information, there's a website called spacetrack.org that has data on it. It's just not enough in the way the environment is going. So I would say financial risk is probably the number one thing. And over a bit longer term, yeah, there's an environmental risk.
So what I'm hearing is this is really not applicable for a space policy directive. Is my understanding correct?
No, we have plenty of policy and directive right now. We're really at the implementation side of things. It's like, okay, you've been told what to do. How come you're not doing it? So, policy is wonderful, but execution is really where the rubber hits the road, and that was sort of the main point of my op-ed piece. We have great policy about the Space Force. The national security policy for space, I think, basically is fine. It's really now execution. The direction for the Artemis program, again, very straightforward. It's organized, but it's the detail, the execution level questions like when is the contract for the human landing system going to go out? How is that going to be organized? You know, how will the next flights work? Sometimes people, like myself, enjoy doing the policy part and getting that right, and we do, and we need to get it right. But then the next bit is execution. And now that you've got that great policy, what are you doing to actually implement it? Are you building the open architecture data repository? Have you done successful test flights? Do you have, you know, people under contract, or are you buying services, you know, to do the lunar return mission that you say you're interested in doing? So execution, execution, execution.
Listener Sally is in Chicago with an email, and she says, I have read, correct me if I'm wrong, that there are Environmental Protection Act lawsuits going on against operations and assets in space. Can you talk about this?
Sure. There's actually less than meets the eye, but it's not zero. One of the areas of contention, there's some filings before the FCC dealing with complaints by Viasat, which is a geosynchronous satellite communications company, provides high data rate services, and it's been in business for a long time, complaining about SpaceX and their Starlink satellites. And one of the things, of course, the Starlink satellites do is they're brighter than expected. So astronomers have been complaining about that. And SpaceX has been working to try to make them less visible, less reflective. And it's actually an interesting science project because they are unexpectedly bright, and getting them not to be so bright is a challenge. And so the argument in one of the filings Viasat made was that the commission, the FCC, erred in allowing SpaceX to move ahead with Starlink because it failed to file a study under the National Environmental Protection Act, and it's called NEPA, to assess the environmental impact of these satellites, including things like light pollution. Well, I kind of find that to be a weak argument because NEPA does not apply to outer space, has not applied to outer space. Commission has never applied it to outer space. There's, again, another long history for that. But the focus of NEPA is supposed to be about, biospheres, things like, the oceans or land and air and so forth. That's the focus of it. Not about things where humans are not yet. And so there's a number of legal arguments as to why NEPA does not apply in outer space. But there are people who are trying to extend it to space and say that some of the same kind of environmental oversights and things that we do on Earth, we ought to carry some of those practices into space. And again, I think that would be a poor idea because space is its own separate, unique domain, and you can't just, cookie cutter take regulations from an Earth environment and apply them in space.
One of the topics that's very, very interesting and has had a lot of support for almost the entire 20-year history of the space show is your Space Policy Directive 6 for nuclear power and propulsion. Did you envision any realistic timelines, or is it just a policy of intention? Is it going to actually help bring nuclear propulsion to reality?
I think nuclear propulsion is still farther away. I think the thing that it does bring to reality in the nearer term is going to be small modular reactors and power sources. There already are a couple of programs underway within the Department of Energy, within NASA, actually two of them within DOD, within DARPA. There's something called DRACO, which is a kind of a demonstration of a nuclear rocket. There's also a terrestrial program called Project Pele, which is for providing power in remote areas. But, it's one of these small, compact modular reactors. What we need to do is to have, if you will, an ecosystem, a industrial base, not where we build a nuclear thermal propulsion rocket that's a kind of standalone, handcrafted, almost artisanal device that doesn't have any commercial application, but where we build off of a self-sustaining commercial power industry that then makes commercial activities in space and government activities in space much cheaper. So what we did with the policy was try to take kind of these different lines of effort within NASA, DOE, and DOD, get everybody into the right swim lanes. Here's what your job is. Here's what your job is. First job is we need to build the industrial base. First product we want to see is power reactor because we need to be able to do that. We can certainly do the moon without nuclear propulsion. It would really help to have nuclear power. And then when you start talking about Mars, you really need nuclear power and you really need nuclear propulsion for going to Mars. So what we tried to lay out was here is a orderly, reasonably logical process. It doesn't envision a totally government-only program. It envisions building up an industry that government can leverage off of, and it tries to put things in some, you know, sort of logical order. So we have separate activities, but they're all part of a unified effort. So it's, to my mind, the nuclear power policy was not just a nice thing to say, it was, but it's also on top of existing real programs that are making progress. So is it fast enough as people would like? No. But certainly the ground-based small modular reactor stuff, that's pretty real, and we'll certainly see that, you know, in the next few years. I think we're looking at another decade or so before we see nuclear thermal propulsion systems, however.
I have some listeners that propose changing rules, so let's forget for a minute technology or capability. They want to have nuclear for launch. Do you ever see anything like that happening?
Not off of the Earth. Nuclear launch off of the moon, possible, off of Mars, possible. A live nuclear reactor operating on Earth launch, probably not. You look at, we spent a long time, again, working in the UN system to get everybody on the same page for nuclear safety. And, you know, there was a time when the Soviets would operate nuclear-powered reactors in Earth orbit, and one of them, you know, came crashing down in Canada.
Right.
These were terrible things. These things would corrode and leak. There's radioactive droplets training in space. I mean, it's just kind of a mess. So lighting up and powering up nuclear reactors where they have an opportunity to come back into the Earth's biosphere is probably not a good thing. So we did update the launch criteria for launching nuclear material and power sources. The last time there had been a look at this was during the Carter administration. And so the memo we updated had originally been signed off by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Carter's national security advisor at the time. And we updated it to be more modern. We kind of basically streamlined the regulations so agencies would have more responsibility for larger amounts of nuclear material they wanted to launch. But again, if it came to something really large, like a live nuclear reactor that would be locked on launch, I don't think we're going there. I think that's probably too dangerous and something we would do off-planet but not in the biosphere.
Ken is in Denver, Colorado, with a question for you. This one's probably a far stretch. But Ken says, you've talked quite a bit in the earlier part of this discussion about space traffic management. So I would like to know if it is too far of a stretch to take the recently released Friday congressional report on UAP, where they said these unidentified objects were a traffic management risk and they needed to get more data about it. Could these objects also be a space traffic management risk?
I don't know that I've seen any tracking of these objects, you know, to space or to orbit. You know, what I've seen, certainly publicly available, have been certainly could pose a hazard to, you know, aircraft, you know, and ships operating within region, but it's all in the air or underwater. I haven't seen these things, you know, tracking to orbit. Now, maybe if we had better space traffic management systems and better sensor systems, you know, could we get a radar lock and hold it all the way to orbit? That would be interesting to see. You know, are they coming from space or are they completely here? I mean, you know, all the usual joking aside, I mean, the bottom line answer is I don't know of anybody who knows what these things are. They are literally unidentified phenomena. And so that's what we're stuck with, and we basically would need a lot more data. I haven't seen anything that would link them into making it to orbit. I can't rule that out. So if I had a better space traffic management system, you know, maybe I might be able to correlate a track from that with a track that, say, is observed by, you know, some naval aviators. That would be really interesting.
Did you ever get intelligence on these items when you were over there at the National Space Council?
Well, I can't comment on that. I knew people working on it, you know, the answer you get is you just shrug your shoulders and go, I don't know what that is. What I find interesting is that is that there really isn't much of a stigma about it. You know, there certainly was a time when people would look at that and kind of laugh or just kind of want to avoid the topic. I think it's actually kind of good that we're just saying, hey, there are things that we're seeing that we don't know what they are. You know, and as an ex-physics person, I find this really interesting because if anything, it's new physical phenomena we can't explain. And you don't have to believe in aliens to go, if there's new and interesting physical phenomena, we have an opportunity to learn something, you know, from this. Certainly going to need Kathy Leaders over in Human Spaceflight at NASA, you know,
right.
Her quip, and it's only, I think, only half joking, is, hey, if anybody knows how these things work, please call me, because I could use this. I think we're still just in an unknown situation, but we're trying to deal with them in a more systematic way. And like I said, for one reason or another, the stigma is largely off of it, and I think people are approaching this with an open mind.
Well, I've offered the space show platform for years to them, but nobody's reached out to contact me. So,
well, now there's a public report, and you know, people can point to something. You know, a lot of these things, until there's something that's in the public, you know, you just sit there and you really can't say anything. So you have to have something you can point to.
You have another phone call. Hi, listener. Who are you and where are you, please? And thank you for calling.
Hi, David. This is Gene in Pasadena.
Hi, Gene.
Hi. I had a question for Dr. Pace. You mentioned, Dr. Pace, that that the current administration, the Biden administration, and a lot of Democrats in Congress are focusing on NASA's possible role in some climate change issues. And I saw a lot of those questions when Nelson was, being interviewed by the House a few days ago, and also by the Senate committee, you know, a month and a half ago before he was sworn in. So I just wondered if what you're thinking is on the possibility of NASA, dusting off this solar power satellite concept. And if, because of the climate change potential of that on a worldwide basis, if NASA might get some interest and support from the legislators that are sort of guiding what NASA might do with their funding, and possibly even leading to an increase in their funding to pursue this, just for risk reduction and proof of concept and, you know, that sort of thing, it might open up a market, a commercial market, a little further down the road. So what's your thinking on that connection?
It's possible, but I think it's a long shot. I think that if you look at something where you're trying to replace a energy system like that, someplace the Department of Energy would probably be the more logical place. I could imagine NASA supporting it, just as I imagine NASA being a supporting element for, like, the climate change work. I don't see them necessarily being on point for it as, you know, being a development agency. There's a lot of progress that's been made, I think, as solar power satellites that make them potentially attractive for space-to-space power beaming or for delivering power to, say, a remote location on the moon. Using them to replace baseload electric power, I think, still is a long shot. My friend John Mankins may disagree with me on this, but I still don't see the business case closing, but I can certainly see niche applications, like for DOD, providing power in remote locations where you don't have to, you know, haul things over dangerous roads. So a supporting element in it, proof of concept, demo, yes, sure, for space applications, I could see it. But it would probably need to be something like what we did with the Space Nuclear of Power work, which is saying, here's the general theme area, you know, solar power satellite. Here are the agencies who are involved in it. Here are the roles and missions that each one of them should play. And then, you know, move forward in a fairly reasonably coordinated manner, rather than saying to one agency, you know, here's a large stack of money, please go, you know, demo this program. Because if it's going to be successful, it needs to be tied into the commercial industry. And really, the Department of Energy has more of those ties than NASA does. So I could see NASA being part of it. I wouldn't see them leading it.
You mentioned a little bit earlier that NASA has really got the ability, perhaps more than many other federal agencies, to work with other agencies. You know, they have a kind of an outreach to the Agriculture Department and Defense and, yep, and Department of Energy and that sort of thing. So it seems to me that they might be an interesting central player to, since, you know, the actual structure itself is going to be in space, and I'm not sure how much the Department of Energy knows about that, but they might be an interesting kind of a central player and then bring in these other agencies, possibly through the Space Council, to pursue this. I'm sure you remember that back in the 70s, that solar power satellite concept during the oil embargo surfaced, and it was sort of being batted back and forth between NASA and the new Department of Energy back in the late 70s. And something like that might crop up here if it wasn't sort of directed. Most people that I've spoken with see space solar power as a space project first, and yeah, followed very closely by the energy aspects. Anyhow, that's what's your thinking on that.
No, I agree with that, the tendency that people see it, and I'm probably the opposite. I probably see it as an energy project primarily, and then the space aspect is really secondary. I mean, it's very simple to understand why people think of it as a space project, and it's very very dramatic and very large, and you've got to have rockets to launch it and all that sort of thing. But its success or failure really turns on whether or not it's a successful energy source. You know, does it outcompete, you know, renewables? Does it outcompete or competitive with nuclear? If so, where? So the space stuff is very visible, but the core problem really is an energy problem, not a space problem. Building large structures in space, we could certainly learn something from doing that. You know, new generations of photovoltaic cells or power conversion systems, certainly we could learn, you know, things from that. But I'm probably different than maybe other folks in that I see the space part as relatively secondary to the energy and economics aspect of it.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your thoughts on it. Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Gene.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Listeners, there's still time if you would like to give us a call. It is 1-866-687-7223. Ashley is in Miami, and Ashley says, do you think there might be additional funding cut loose for a second lunar human lander?
Yeah, I think there's going to be. I think, first of all, I mean, SpaceX made a terrific proposal, and incredibly competitive, not only technically, but also economically. But I think what we learned from the, from our space station experience, having sort of two dissimilar ways of getting somewhere, in our case, shuttle on one hand and then a Russian Soyuz on another, is really important for reliability. And so having another, you know, we did the same thing with, you know, Commercial Crew. You couldn't tell, at the beginning whether or not, Boeing or SpaceX was going to be first or more successful. And, of course, over time, very clear SpaceX was successful. But I'm not the most trusting of people. And so I'm not going to probably say a priori that one company or another is going to be the best. And I will always want to have a backup. And so I think having a backup, if it turns out that there is not a really good economic affordable backup that can be done, then, you know, the next thing you do is you look at having a government solution as a backup. JPL has landed lots of things on Mars. They actually were involved in early lunar landings. You could imagine having a JPL or a NASA field center with traditional government contractors, you know, building another system. I don't think that would be the preferable approach. I think that what we'll try to do with human lander systems is to do things more innovatively. We have existing traditional programs of record like SLS and Orion. We did more innovative programs in the case of Commercial Crew and Cargo. We did HLS as a public-private partnership. So I would hope that there will be a second public-private partnership option. But if pressed, and we need to have, you know, again, a backup, you know, there's always a government backup, government-directed as an option to make sure you're not dependent on just one way of getting to the money.
Randy is in Oklahoma City with a question, and he said, SLS has had problems and controversy since its start. It's clearly full of cost overruns, and it doesn't pencil out anything close to what, say, SpaceX is doing. How can SLS still be justified by the government?
Well, I think one of the things is that SLS certainly is something that's here, and hopefully here soon, in terms of flying, doing through the green run, getting the initial launches in. The core stages, you know, have been bought for the first three to four of these missions. And I think what Jim Bridenstine said was correct, is that there's an option to do a commercial buy of heavy lift capability in the future. You know, he would be open-minded to it, and I think Bill Nelson would be open-minded to it. Then you look at when the decisions, you know, were made, you know, back in those times, I think having an option for a heavy lift vehicle was something I think everybody wanted because we needed it to eventually go to Mars. It was not clear that there was going to be a commercial option over there. Now that commercial options have come along. We're still not fully there yet, but we're making great progress. I think we build and complete the SLS program. We look at where we are with it. We look at whether or not going forward, do we want to buy commercial services? Do we still operate the SLS? I think that's still a decision, you know, that's open to be made. You know, we could probably spend the entire several hours going over the forensics of, you know, how SLS got off track, what it's taken to get it back on track, what's happened in recent years versus what happened at the beginning. But at the end of the day, we need to have a large heavy lift capability. SLS is one way of doing it. It may not be the best way of doing it eventually, but I'm not ready to say we need to stop it right now. I'd like to see the first couple of launches get going. I'd like to see if they can bring the cost down, because right now one of the biggest problems with SLS is just the affordability. It's really hard to have a sustainable lunar program with the cost points that are there for the first couple of launches. It's not sustainable. If the cost can come down, great. We've got a competitive option. If they don't come down, then that produces a more of a market opportunity for maybe a commercial heavy lift version, which doesn't yet exist, but hopefully might be if the government demand is there. So, long answer.
We're sort of getting near the end of 90 minutes. And, you know, you mentioned and you sort of affirmed, and everybody else has as well, too, that we are a very highly partisan, divided country right now, but space kind of stands alone and has seemed to avoid getting caught in that trap. Are you optimistic that space can stay out of the partisan mess of the rest of the country, or is there a risk that it might just succumb to what's going on?
There's always a risk. I mean, human beings can screw up almost anything. So, you know, never rule that out. So I think you don't take that support for granted. You try to, you know, reach out and be as inclusive as you can of people's views, that people to take pride in this thing as an American activity. You know, you don't just assume it's going to be there because it's been there in the past. I think you work really hard at keeping it nonpartisan, and you work really hard at using the space program to point to you know, values that we all have in common. Things like, you know, hard work and achievement, and doing things that are inspirational, and showing the kind of the rich tapestry that makes up, you know, the American population that contributes and is part of this from all kinds of places, all geographic locations and ethnicities and backgrounds and whatever. That I think is really the benefit of the program, the unifying element. I think where we could go bad is if we thought that the space program was the exclusive preserve of any you know, one group of people or people with a particular ideological viewpoint or a particular background or so forth. It belongs to everybody. And so you just have to work hard at keeping it that way.
Anything we should be keeping our eyes on with the new administration going forward, maybe particularly between now and the end of the year? We're already more than half a year into it. So what do you see for space, for NASA, for policy? What's on the horizon?
I think if I was to point to an area that we did not get to in policy, would be that of Earth sensing, Earth global Earth sensing generally. We did a lot of work on streamlining commercial remote sensing regulations. We did a lot of work in trying to get the weather satellite programs back into shape. Not fully there yet. And we've gone back and forth with how DoD buys commercial data and imagery from the private sector. And we have a very good earth science program. What we don't have is an overall national strategy about how all these different sectors, civil, commercial, security, work together, how they relate to private industry, and they relate to international partners. I mean, Europeans have built a very capable earth remote sensing system, a network called Copernicus. There's large international groups, group on earth observations, that coordinate taking data of the Earth. We've created a national strategy on space weather, but we don't really have a national strategy on Earth remote sensing generally. We have stuff on different sectors. So if I was to pick an area for maybe a comprehensive policy review, something like that, I think would probably be of interest. And again, given the Biden administration's interest in climate issues, that maybe that would be something that the Space Council would like to take on. That being said, there's not a lot of area where I think we need a lot of new policy. What we need is a lot of areas to just simply executing stuff we have on the books. So Artemis, Space Force, preparing for what comes after Space Station. And programmatically, we really need to face up to the fact the station is not going to last forever. And we don't want to have a situation where we have a bad day, we have to demand the station, and the Chinese are the only ones up there with a space station. You know, good for them, but bad for us. So I think more definition about what comes after space station certainly would be helpful. And I think just working on executing everything that's already kind of on the books. So I think hopefully the space portion of the Biden administration will be quiet but productive.
Do we need a government space station after ISS, or should we help to enable private space stations?
Well, loaded question, David, because my view, we're not going to build another space station like this. None of the partners, I think, wants to repeat, what they've already done. And we shouldn't have a dependency on a single system. I would love to see the government be a strong anchor tenant and buyer, and I'd like to see a couple of different stations. Maybe not even permanently manned. They could be crew tended from time to time. Maybe one in polar, one in maybe a high inclination trailing orbit, using parts maybe salvaged from station. Something in low Earth orbit, 28.5 degrees, due east of Florida. It's easier to get to. So I would like to see a situation of multiple, more diverse privately owned platforms with a government as a big customer, because I think that'll be necessary. But it doesn't have to be the only customer. It shouldn't be the only customer, and there shouldn't be just one. We want to maintain the partnership that we've built with the internationals, but I'd like to see it working on something more ambitious, like continuing the partnership but out of the moon. And that's hopefully what will come next.
You have a question. This might be the last one of the day. It's an email from Adrian in San Diego, and he says, and I think he's talking about debris and maybe some of the climate change amelioration technology, but he says, I don't see any concrete multinational effort on the table, so what kind of optimism is there for any kind of action?
Well, on orbital, on space situational awareness and on orbital debris cleanup, I think there's a lot of, should be a lot of optimism, but where the source of that optimism is really with the private sector. If I look at some of the private capabilities that are available like now, being demonstrated now for space situational awareness, it's really tremendous. I mean, the mega constellations haven't gone up just on faith. They've gone up because they also know how to get data about where the systems are and how they're functioning. So I'm very confident that it is possible. And again, of course, we screw it up, but I'm very confident that we have capabilities, private sector capabilities, to provide the kind of SSA information we need to support good space traffic management decisions. I've also seen the demonstrations by Northrop Grumman, some of the new stuff that Astroscale is proposing, and some other smaller companies around, that we have the ability to remove pieces of debris that pose a long-term threat. So on that, again, I think I'm optimistic. Again, as with many things, the technical solutions are often easier than the policy or political solutions. I think the fact that there are technical solutions means that we will eventually, not immediately, we will eventually get to implementing those solutions. But it'll tend to be a bottom-up kind of thing. I don't see space traffic management and orbital debris being solved in a top-down manner, because there really is no central organizing entity that everybody would really get behind. It'll tend to be more of a distributed solution than it will be a centralized one.
Anything we should have discussed or asked you about that we've left out or omitted or forgotten or didn't realize we should ask you?
I don't know. I think that we're going to see probably more attention paid as we get the first commercial landers on the moon, getting science information back. We're going to see more interest in what is possible with using lunar resources. You know, we talk about that a lot over the years, but we don't really have good data on what it would really take. We're going to see some of the first experiments for getting water ice out of lunar soil. We're going to need probably nuclear power sources to help do that in the permanently darkened regions. And so these issues of space resources are probably going to become more immediate. They're not immediate right now because we don't have, you know, missions actually landing and doing this sort of thing. But, you know, there was a time when we didn't think space debris was a big topic or was most a theoretical one. So as we get more robotic missions back to the moon, we'll watch for the space resource issue to move out to a more visible, more public form.
I got an 11th hour email for you from Dwayne in Cincinnati, and he says, all in all, with the mention of the private sector, maybe the lunar south pole, where do you come down on property rights? Do we need them? Are they okay as is in the Outer Space Treaty? Is this something that needs to be developed further?
Well, I think this is something that does need to be developed further, but I think we can do it in the context of the Outer Space Treaty. We certainly clearly own the rocks and resources that we took from the moon. The thing that is banned is ownership of resources in situ. You know, we can't plant a flag on the surface and say we own this piece of land. But we certainly own the rocks, and we can certainly use the resources that we might extract. We've developed ways of allocating resources internationally in the past. If you think about geosynchronous orbit, nobody owns the orbital slot, but we have a process by where we can get access to them and adjudicate them. The same thing could be done for other places in space, like the Lagrange points, if you really wanted to. And there'll be some way to coordinate safety zones and areas to operate routinely on the lunar surface. Again, not necessarily claiming the ownership of the resources in situ. There have been some good international discussions. I've been in a number of them, both formally and informally. You know, in some areas, like I say, we have a lot of differences with China, but on space resources, actually,
we probably see more eye to eye. And the main thing that everybody wants is that there be some agreement on international process by which this is done, that it not be done just unilaterally by one country and ignoring everyone else. So they people want to have a discussion about it. They want to understand how this might evolve over time. And that's where things like the Artemis Accords are kind of a start. They're not the end of the conversation, but the Artemis Accords are kind of like the beginning of the conversation. I think as we see actual cases develop, we'll have more dialogue with the Artemis signatory countries. And I hope we might even see China and Russia as signatories. There's no fundamental reason why they can't be, even though we have lots of other political differences. So, hopeful.
Dr. Pace, I want to thank you for staying with us for 90 minutes and covering so many topics. It's been a great discussion, and it's good to have you back on the Space Show. And I look forward to talking to you again down the road. And thank you for your insights and great information. We really appreciate
good
it.
Luck and hope you enjoy Las Vegas. And if you just do decide to make that move, just remember, if you don't think we can colonize hostile alien worlds, I mean, why are you in Vegas?
Well, you might say the same for why are you in California. So,
well, why am I in Washington D.C.?
I think you got another quick question. Do you have time to answer it
sure.
Real quick? This is again from Adrian in San Diego. He says China will honor the Outer Space Treaty just like they honor the international rights of passage in the South China Sea. So it's not really a question. It's more a statement of his opinion. But I'm sure you've heard that opinion from others. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, that's why there's a concern. The Chinese are very scrupulous about obeying the U.N. Convention on Law of the Sea everywhere outside of the South China Sea. So where their national interests come into conflict with international law, they, of course, pick their own national interests. The question is, will that pattern of behavior continue in space? Yep, that's a risk. Is it possible that space could be different in terms of behavior, maybe because they don't feel their interests are quite so obvious as far as their behavior in Antarctica and cyberspace and the South China Sea? So I kind of prefer to leave the door open to good behavior while still condemning bad behavior in other domains.
To be determined, right?
To be determined.
Scott, thank you again, and maybe if we can do space conferences in person again, I'll get to see you again. I look forward to it, and I'll send you the archive program. And again, many thanks for staying with us and for responding to all our questions and comments, and my best to you for the rest of the weekend. And listeners, that's it for today, so I thank you for your emails and calls. There's still time to enjoy the weekend, so please do so. Please stay safe. Please stay healthy. As always, keep looking up, and goodbye from Scott, David, and The Space Show.